Congress couldn't agree, so President Trump picked up a pen. But what exactly will his executive actions over the weekend do? Today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Trial by Zoom, how a couple of cases in San Antonio and Austin could set precedent across the country. The road to a vaccine. Efforts for a COVID-19 vaccine are moving much faster than usual. How's that working? Schools are reopening, and families are making decisions about whether and how to send kids back. We'll hear from a few. And an East Texas man wins big in a lawsuit, and we're not talking money, today on The Standard. This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. It's Monday, August 10th, and it's still summertime in Texas, as the temperatures show. A high today of 96 in Alpine, 99 in Arlington, and 100 in Abilene. But in a way, it's also starting to feel like fall. That's because classes are starting soon in school districts across the state. This, of course, is going to be a back-to-school season like no other. Families of students, teachers, and staff are weighing the safety of returning. They're also dealing with other impacts of the pandemic, perhaps unemployment, maybe the risk of eviction. And there's uncertainty in all of that. As Congress has been gridlocked on a stimulus package, President Donald Trump picked up a pen over the weekend, but the uncertainty remains. Todd Gilman has been watching it all unfold from the nation's capital, where he is D.C. bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. Todd, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
It's great to be with you.
President Trump signed a number of things over the weekend. What did he say he was going to do, and what do these orders, executive actions, actually do?
Well, there is, in fact, a very large gap between what he said he was going to do and what the executive orders do. Take, for example, the payroll tax hiatus, which, first of all, only affects certain taxpayers under, I think, $60,000 income. The president doesn't have the authority to waive the payroll tax. You still owe the tax. So what he said he was doing is giving tax relief to middle-income taxpayers. But what he's actually doing is allowing them to defer payments, which they will still owe next year. So the executive orders that he announced and signed actually show not so much presidential authority as the limits of presidential authority. Hmm. He announced extended unemployment benefits, but the plan that he rolled out relies on cooperation from states that he hasn't actually gotten governors on board for yet. So there's a lot of bluster, and a lot of it is positioning so that it looks like he, the president, is doing things that Congress, and specifically the Democrats, can't do or won't do for you, the voter. But a lot of it is more talk than deliverable.
Another mentioned item was student loans. That's something a lot of folks are paying attention to. Do we know what happened there?
Now, that is something that the president has direct authority to do, and that I'm a little more familiar with the weeds on because I have three kids with student loans, unfortunately. And what he did was he extended the emergency deferral of both interest and payments for students, which was going to expire in September, and extended that through the end of December. So it's another 3 months of forbearance for anyone with student loans that would otherwise be in repayment. So that is relief, and a lot of students are, recently graduated students and even people who are out 10 years are struggling economically, and so that could be a pretty significant jolt for recent college graduates.
Okay, so we can count that one up as something that folks listening can count on. But do we know what these other actions necessarily mean for Texans? Some of these orders, as you mentioned, rely on some cooperation from the state. Are we waiting for some state reaction here on a more local level to figure that out?
We are. As we're talking here on Monday morning, I am unaware of where Governor Abbott stands, or even whether Governor Abbott, unilaterally without legislature approval, has the authority to agree to the one-quarter match on the extended unemployment benefits. So the president's plan would be to add this $400 a week benefit for unemployment, but states would have to pony up one quarter of that. As far as I know, no governors were aware of this plan ahead of it being announced. And for Texans who have been receiving this extended benefit, I think they need to stay tuned to find out whether the state government is going to go along with it.
All right. So we know from lots of past experience, there's politics and then there's reality. Does Trump win the politics, though, here, even if the reality is completely unknown and a lot of fine print and a lot of arguing?
I'm not sure, but I would guess that he wins the politics with the people who already believe everything that he says. And they will hear him saying, well, the Democrats in Congress, Pelosi, refused to do this, and therefore I am coming to the rescue. The really tricky part of this politics is he's actually kind of boxing out the Senate Republicans as well, because they were the ones who would not come up with any alternative plan to the one that the House passed in May. Mm-hmm. So there could have been a normal kind of congressional process here. The House passed something. The Senate could have passed something, and they could have gone to conference committee. Instead, the White House and its Republican allies in the Senate decided to stretch out the negotiations. But either way, what the president is doing by coming out and saying, well, I'm going to do these executive orders because Congress can't get anything done, is not so subtly jabbing Senate Republicans. He's almost throwing them under the bus. Like, I'm the only guy in Washington who can get things done against Nancy Pelosi. It's a very tricky effort at triangulation.
Todd Gilman is Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Todd, thank you again.
Sure thing.
Families across Texas are gearing up for back to school after weeks of mixed messages. Corpus Christi ISD is one that starts up this week. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has stressed local school boards should decide how to reopen classrooms and says local health officials can close schools only after an outbreak. Houston Public Media's Laura Isensee tells us it's left many parents struggling to decide what's the best option for their family.
Virtual school has not been easy for Christina Quintero and her two kids. Her son Fabian has a hard time focusing without his regular routine. He's 5 years old, has autism, and is about to start kindergarten.
My son with special needs has a 15-minute span of learning. We tried doing in-home therapy online, and it tanked. It did not work at all.
And her daughter Valentina is headed to first grade and has shown signs of anxiety.
She goes, Mom, I feel my heart heavy. I just feel sad. I don't want to do anything. I'm like, well, let's go, you know, outside. Let's play outside. Let's go swimming in your little pool or something. Mom, it sounds like fun, but I don't want to do it.
Still, Quintero prefers her children learn at home this fall. She'll coach them as best she can with a cell phone and a tablet, though she's worried they'll lose their internet since her husband's out of work.
I've never felt like online would work for my family, but I feel like it's the right choice right now because it's a responsible thing to do as a parent, not just for my kids, but for my neighbor's kids, for my nieces and nephews, for other children in the community.
Like much of Texas, Greater Houston is struggling to contain the coronavirus. Many districts won't reopen brick-and-mortar classrooms until after Labor Day. Some will teach remotely for weeks, including Fort Bend and Houston. Others will offer face-to-face instruction much sooner, starting with Humble ISD in August.
You know, I believe that every parent has the right to choose for their own children.
Ryan Cotton has three children in Humble schools. He leads a Facebook group to advocate for in-person learning with over 1,000 members.
I believe that the school is a safe place for my child to return with the proper safety measures in place, but there are parents who don't feel safe, and I absolutely respect that.
Other parents are organizing mini schools called learning pods. The trend's drawn controversy because only certain families can afford to hire tutors, and it could widen gaps in opportunity for Texas children.
And I don't think anybody feels 100% great about the decision that they're making.
Susie Kennan is the president of the Texas PTA.
Because what we all want is just to return to school in a normal environment, right?
Kennan says what's made it harder? Conflicting messages from state and local leaders, especially about funding and who can close schools.
We tell people to quarantine for 14, right? But we're only going to shut the campus down for 5 for fear of funding. And so it just feels like those decisions need to be made by local school boards and superintendents. And they need to be able to make those decisions based on safety as their first concern, not funding.
Safety remains the top concern for parents like Robert Turner. He's an oil and gas manager turned stay-at-home dad. This summer, he's tried to keep his 2 girls engaged. One of their favorite games, playing with Peppa the Pig on the computer.
Where did you find the sounds?
I just found
some of the sound effects, yeah. Maybe?
Turner's relieved they'll have virtual school until October, though says it'll be tough.
So it was almost like that feeling all over again. It's like, man, you know, I don't want to have to do this, but it's, you know, in the best interest of our kids.
Turner says the outbreak in Houston makes it too dangerous for kids and adults.
We can't just put blinders on and say that's not happening. It is. It's a real thing that's happening, and it affects all of our health.
He worries if schools reopen too soon, they'll shut down all over again. In Houston, I'm Laura Eisensee.
Checking in on the talk of Texas on social media is our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hey, Wells.
Hey, Laura. Hearing from our friends and listeners about President Trump's murky executive actions over the weekend on our Facebook page, Pat Snow says this about the payroll tax cut, which Trump has said he would like to make permanent should he serve another term. All of us senior citizens realize what's going to happen to Social Security and Medicare if the GOP stays in the White House, indeed the payroll tax funding both of those entities. As for that $400 a week boost in unemployment payments, a quarter of which would be needed to be paid by the state's Jerry Harp. Notes that states don't have the money to fund a $100 raise in unemployment payments. And additionally, Robert Flood writes, one has to hope that no natural disaster hits America this year because money is slated to be redirected from FEMA for those unemployment payments. And we have heard about the increase in named storms projected for this year concerning news, to be sure. Mm-hmm. Just one of the stories we're watching, Laura. I'll be back with more later on.
And we'd like to hear what you think about Trump's executive order, about going back to school, about whatever's going on in your neck of Texas. You can find us on social media. Wells Dunbar is watching.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. The COVID-19 pandemic has hit airlines hard. The industry has seen empty planes, pilot layoffs, and massive financial losses. But the outbreak has also deeply affected the rest of the aviation community. Texas Public Radio's Jerry Clayton is a pilot. He explores how the pandemic has changed a complicated world with a simple name, general aviation.
Joseph Longuero lives in the Austin area. He owns a single-engine Cirrus SR-22. It's a fast, modern, glass cockpit, 4-seat airplane.
When it first happened, I was taking lessons for my instructor's license, the CFI. You know, the flight schools weren't taking people. And then flying someplace was like, every place you go is closed.
Pilots like Longuero, on-demand air charter pilots, cargo pilots, corporate and business aviation, aircraft owners who fly for personal or business reasons, and much more, they all fall under the category general aviation. According to the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, general aviation provides more than 1% of the United States GDP, accounting for 1.3 million jobs in professional services and manufacturing. And the COVID-19 pandemic has touched most every one of those jobs. Lewis pilots a corporate jet. He declined to give TPR his last name so as to protect the privacy of the aircraft's owners. His plane can accommodate a dozen passengers. It's used for personal and business trips for the owners and sometimes leased out for on-demand charter trips.
Prior to COVID, we were averaging probably 5 days a month of flying charter. As of March 20th, we've only done really two charter flights.
Al Hyde is a retired airline captain. He's now a contract pilot flying the Pilatus PC-12 single-engine turboprop for several different owners. He generally flew about 45 to 50 hours per month, but then the COVID-19 pandemic hit.
It went to zero for 2 months. For, I think it was April and May, went to zero.
But now, he says it's slowly picking up again.
I started flying again in June and a few trips and July, so I'm back to flying a couple of times a week. And I see on the schedule that's looks like it's going to increase again. So we're headed back to, I would say, about 60% or so of what I was doing.
And other aspects of general aviation seem to be doing quite well economically. For example, air cargo operations. The Bureau of Transportation Statistics recently reported that domestic air cargo is either holding steady or slightly up from this time last year. And there's at least some anecdotal evidence that the cargo business is flying these days like it's Christmas year-round, possibly because more people are stuck at home shopping online. Flight schools are starting to come back, too. Casey Ratliff owns and operates Texas Skies Flight School at Bernie Stage Airport, just northwest of San Antonio. When the lockdowns began in March, Ratliff says his business dropped dramatically. But now he's seeing a new kind of customer coming out to learn to fly.
There's a percentage of people out there that, you know, feel like commercial flying has become even much more of a hassle or a risk, if you will. And so, I've had a group of clientele that has spawned because of the outbreak, you know, wanting to learn how to fly so that they can just get themselves from point A to point B.
He's also seeing more young people who are looking to get into aviation as a profession.
You know, the next generation of pilots, we still got to produce those. And I think some of those kids actually have a little foresight into that and are out here, you know, learning how to fly.
No one can predict the future of aviation, especially during a pandemic. But one thing's for sure. There are and always will be people who look to the sky and want to be there, far above a troubled world. I'm Jerry Clayton in San Antonio.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. As the world rearranged for the pandemic, some of what used to happen in person now happens over screens. The same is true in the legal system. Since the pandemic forced courts to close their doors, there have been just a few jury trials in Texas state courts. That's about to change as state courts in Austin and San Antonio prepare for more virtual jury trials via Zoom. Here to tell us more about it is Angela Morris. She's a reporter for Texas Lawyer. Angela, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much.
Unlike what we see on TV, not every court case goes to trial. But for those that need a trial, what's been happening during the pandemic and the resulting shutdown? Did the legal process just stop?
As for jury trials, that would be an accurate statement. But judges have been doing bench trials since April.
And this has been different in Texas state courts versus federal courts. Can you explain the difference?
Sure. Texas's federal courts have been holding some limited numbers of jury trials since June. Texas state courts are subjected to a Texas Supreme Court order that basically prohibits judges from having jury trials with limited exceptions. So if a judge wants to have a jury trial, they have to get approval and come up with a plan to keep people safe.
So what happens on August 19th in Austin and San Antonio, and how unique is it?
Well, under this experimental jury trial program that's been running this summer here in Austin and in San Antonio. In the next 2 weeks, there are going to be two totally virtual jury trials done over Zoom. The jury selection, the presentation of evidence, the verdict, all of it is going to be virtual.
So this is obviously kind of an experiment. Are other courts expected to follow suit, or maybe not so quickly?
I think we have to wait and see. But there is a huge incentive for courts to find a way to start back up with jury trials, because they are fundamental to our form of government. Each one of us has a constitutional right to a jury trial.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of cases that are pending that need resolution. Your judges are serious about getting justice for those cases on their docket. So there's got to be some way to start back up with jury trials. It's simply not acceptable to have no jury trial.
Yeah. So what's happening in the meantime? Are some people waiting behind bars, just waiting and waiting and waiting?
I'm sure there are. I know judges have done so much work and really everything they can to try to grant pretrial release to those people that they can. But certainly, I mean, there are going to be some criminal defendants that they can't release. And so, yeah, I mean, they would have to wait for their trial.
What protection do courts have against more appeals down the road because their trial was by a virtual jury? I mean, do you see this eventually being something where the losing party would have more grounds for an appeal?
It's hard for me to answer. And honestly, I think it would be hard for anybody to answer that, because this is the first time ever in our history that we would ever have a virtual jury trial. But I'll tell you this, like, if somebody loses their jury trial, especially in the criminal system where their life and liberty is at mm-hmm. stake, I mean, they would have a huge incentive to appeal based on any sort of issue that they can find in their case. And I can't imagine that they wouldn't jump on the issue of, you know, my jury trial was remote over Zoom, because we have a constitutional right. When we're charged with a crime, we have a constitutional right to face our accuser. And that has been determined to be, like, in person.
Angela Morris is a reporter for Texas Lawyer who covers litigation. Angela, thank you again.
Thank you too, Laura.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, sharing that regular screenings like mammograms and colonoscopies are essential preventative appointments. Early detection of cancer often leads to better outcomes. More at TexasOncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas Democrats are ramping up efforts to increase voting by mail in the November election. The party plans to send out more than 1.7 million absentee ballot applications this month to eligible voters, such as those who are at least 65 years old or people with disabilities. State party spokesperson Abi Rahman says applications will go first to residents in the major metro areas.
We send out like an envelope, a stamp, and the application. So all you have to do is just fill it out, put it in your envelope, and then put it in your mailbox, and then you're good to go. So it's a very simple and streamlined process, something that we think could really change the game here in Texas.
State Republican leaders have refused to expand mail-in voting to all voters during the coronavirus pandemic. GOP State Senator Pat Fallon will be on the ballot this November to succeed former Texas Congressman John Ratcliffe, who left office last spring to become the Director of National Intelligence. Republican leaders in the 4th Congressional District in Northeast Texas nominated Fallon on Saturday. Fallon, who's serving his first term in the Texas Senate, is expected to defeat Democrat Russell Foster in the reliably red district. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Department is mourning three employees killed over the weekend in a helicopter crash in Brewster County. Marfa Public Radio's Carlos Morales reports they were surveying desert bighorn sheep.
The three men, identified as wildlife biologist Dewey Stockbridge, fish and wildlife technician Brandon White, and state wildlife veterinarian Dr. Bob Dittmar, were working on the Black Gap Wildlife Management Area, which borders Big Bend National Park. It's unclear at the moment what caused Saturday's fatal crash. Texas Parks and Wildlife Department's Executive Director Carter Smith said, quote, "No words can begin to express the depth of sadness we feel for the loss of our colleagues in this tragic accident," end quote. The Texas Department of Public Safety, including the Federal Aviation Administration and the Texas Game Wardens, are investigating the incident. I'm Carlos Morales in Marfa.
Texas Tech University Athletic Director Kirby Hocut is apologizing to members of the women's basketball team for the culture of abuse they faced under head coach Marlene Stollings. She was fired last week after USA Today detailed the experiences of 10 players. That included allegations of sexual harassment from a former strength and conditioning coach, as well as verbal abuse. Hocut said Friday the school failed them.
"They are strong, and I appreciate the strength and the courage that they have displayed. These should be the best years of their lives."
Stollings' original contract with Texas Tech ran through 2024. I'm Joseph Leahy.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the online UT High School, offering a full-time diploma program and a variety of individual courses, including for advanced placement. Learn more about options for the new school year at highschool.utexas.edu.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Vaccines usually take years to develop. They typically require rigorous rounds of trials and long evaluation periods, but that typical process isn't going to work for COVID-19. Saving lives and livelihoods depends on speeding up the typical vaccine development process a lot. But how much risk does that speed introduce into the process? Joining us now to discuss is Dr. Penny Heaton. She's CEO of the Bill and Melinda Gates Medical Research Institute, which develops vaccines and treatments for diseases in low and middle income countries. Dr. Heaton, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
First, that introduction may raise some eyebrows. It comes from distrust that people have about vaccines in general, the pace of the COVID-19 vaccine in particular, and the involvement here of the Gateses. What would you say to those who are feeling concerned?
So, first of all, I think they need to understand what has actually enabled the unprecedented speed with which vaccines are being developed. One of those was prior knowledge of the coronavirus and the fact that we already understood how it causes disease and what we need to target with respect to a vaccine to try to prevent coronavirus disease. The second was just the new vaccine technologies that have emerged over the last several years allow production of thousands of doses for clinical trials very quickly. And then the third was really figuring out activities in parallel. They're not done sequentially. For example, you can do small animal studies and, you know, early toxicology studies and get into phase one while you're finishing up your large animal studies, optimizing your laboratory tests for testing antibody, et cetera.
So you wrote that we're actually seeing the compression of, you know, 6 years worth of work into about 6 months. You say that there's reasons for that here specifically, but are there also risks that go along with moving so quickly?
I think we have to think about the level of risk, if you will. In the normal course of vaccine development, we are looking at things like, what is the unmet medical need? How fast can we move forward? And what are the benefits of moving forward versus the potential risk of this particular vaccine? The vaccine developers are thinking about that same ratio of benefit risk here. So let's say that in the phase one and the phase two studies, that the vaccine developers, you know, they have said, okay, you know, we have found a dose that has that right balance of benefit and risk, and we're going to move into the late stage studies. So you've heard about these recently, where they're moving into the big phase three studies with 30,000 subjects. With that kind of sample size, they'll be able to further characterize the safety and common side effects that are near term to the vaccine in a very robust way, and they'll be able to look at the efficacy of the vaccine. Then what we have to ask ourselves is, are there questions that can only be answered with more time? And the answer to that is yes. There are other things that we'll want to look at is, what about uncommon or rare side effects? What about the duration of efficacy. Are we going to need booster doses? But then the vaccine developers would continue on with what we call life cycle management. So even when vaccines are approved, the safety will continue to be monitored post-approval. So these questions that you can only answer with time and only answer as thousands and millions of people get the vaccine, they will still be answered.
Well, obviously, the enormous question is, how long will it be until we have one that we can, you know, distribute widely? What are the big questions that we need to answer as soon as possible? And how far away are we from knowing those?
So, I mean, the questions that we need to answer are pretty straightforward, actually. Is it safe? Does it work? What's the mechanism by which it works? We think it's antibody. We think it's neutralizing antibody, you know, antibody that actually kills the virus when you're doing, you know, tests in the laboratory demonstrating that. And then the fourth question that sometimes we physicians don't always think of, but that's super important, is can we make it? And can it be manufactured at very high volumes? All of those questions will need to be answered. And I am not directly involved with any development of any of these vaccines. So any estimates that I give you would only be speculation. But I am optimistic from what I'm hearing from colleagues and scientists, et cetera, that in the next, you know, 6 to 12 months that the first vaccine doses could be available.
Dr. Penny Heaton is the CEO of the Bill and Melinda Gates Medical Research Institute. Dr. Heaton, thank you for joining us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
My name is Thora Kadumi. I'm a 77-year-old woman who lives in Houston and wears a mask when I go out. I decided I was going to have a little fun with it. I've been wearing a mask that my sister made for me that was hot, and she worked real hard on it. But I thought, you know, maybe I could get something that would be really special for me. And I thought, well, everybody knows that I have a camel collection. So I thought I'd get one that would go along with that. And so I Googled camel masks. Well, the first thing that I found were these giant head of camel masks that you could wear for Halloween. But I decided that wasn't exactly what I wanted to wear, even though I've seen pictures of people in Walmart or whatever wearing things like that. So I continued looking, and I was surprised to find that there were several design fabric masks that people had sewn. So I chose the one that I thought was cute, reasonably priced, and that it had free shipping. And best of all, there was a really lovely little camel on each side of the stitching. But unfortunately, the very day that I got my mask, I wore it out and I lost it. I probably dropped it on the street while getting out of the car. But, you know, I said, I'm not going to give up. I'll just order another one. Well, it was not quite as good as the mask that I had originally got. The seam in the middle of the mask, you know, had a camel on each side, but one of the camels had no nose. The nose was cut off and it was floating lower on the other side of the mask. But you know what? I love the camel mask anyway. I'm very happy to have it. I do think that people are starting to actually kind of look for a little fun side of it and show their personality through their masks. I don't think I will wear it when this is over, but it'll go with my collection. I started long, long ago. It could have something to do with the fact that I married a Arab, a Palestinian, and maybe I got my first camel way back almost that long ago. I once entered mine in the Fort Bend County Fair, They have a section for collections, and I won a blue ribbon for the best camel collection in Fort Bend County. Well, actually, it was just for the best collection, but I call it the best camel collection. I do not find it burdensome, but I really do feel it makes a huge difference in that you cannot smile at anyone. And I'm a person who often just makes a little comment to somebody when I'm shopping or something. And you don't really feel like doing that when you're wearing a mask because they can't really see you. It's different when you can look at somebody and talk to them. It does emphasize eyes. So you really, eyes can look more beautiful than they did in the past. You notice them. So, I mean, maybe there's some slight advantage if you have beautiful eyes.
That's Thora Kadumi from Houston. Does your face covering express your personality? Does it cause you any serious limitations? We want to hear the story behind your mask. We're tracking this as part of a project marking a unique point in Texas history when all Texans were required to wear masks. Find us on social media or email texasstandard@kut.org. Texas health officials announced guidelines last week for limited visitations in nursing homes amid ongoing concerns over the spread of COVID-19. That's welcome news for some Texans who have gone months separated from loved ones. Over the months of isolation, one woman has chronicled her mother's deterioration at the hands of Alzheimer's. Texas Tech Public Media's Sarah Self-Walbrick spoke with her.
July 18th, 2020. When are you coming to see me? I can't come see you because of the virus that's going around, I told her again. I'll be there when they let me come through the door. I wish you could walk in the door any minute, she said.
That's Jerry Montgomery, reading from the journal she keeps to note conversations with her 91-year-old mother, Carol, who lives in a nursing home 2 hours away and has Alzheimer's. Jerry has been recording their conversations since January, before COVID-19 hit the area, as a way to document the disease's progression. They talk daily, sometimes with the help of nursing home workers, who connect the two on FaceTime. Jerry recalls her mother's reaction to the technology.
Aren't these cell phones quite an invention, she said. She moved the screen around. Put it back where I can see your face, I said. She held the screen in front of her. Now I can see your face, I told her. That's quite a disappointment, she said, smiling.
As they talk, Jerry writes, she told me she's envious of the shorthand her mother was so good at. Jerry's a former journalist who now lives on a ranch near Childress. She's documented history and even journaled for years, but this is different. Carol still knows her daughter, even though it's been 7 years since she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Jerry says her mom tends to go back to happy memories, time spent with her husband, and days on the lake.
Sunday, March 8th, 2020. Good morning, Mom. What are you doing? Well, hi. I'm sitting here waiting for a plane. Where are you going? She was going home. No, Mom, you're in Lubbock. I guess I better not wait for a plane, she said in a joking fashion. Still has her wit.
Jerry describes Carol as a strong-willed woman. She raised 3 kids, earned multiple degrees, and was a nurse practitioner in women's health. A point of pride for Carol was making the highest score on her state board exam, in a class of 1,300. Her husband Ralph died in 2013, and Carol was diagnosed with Alzheimer's soon after. Jerry thinks her mother has recently gotten worse.
Now, 4 months into the journey, my mother, in one of her more lucid moments, said to me, I feel empty tonight without anybody I love.
Loneliness is a common theme in these conversations.
The loneliness that occurs in patients with dementia prevents them from being as functional as they normally would be.
Dr. Stephen Burke is the dean of the School of Medicine at the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center. He's researched nursing homes and geriatric care for years. Burke says the Montgomerys aren't the only family suffering the emotional toll of separation. Families play a big role in residents' routines.
Patients with dementia are always getting advice from their family. The family member may be the first one to say, are they taking too much medicine? Family members have always been part of the care of patients in nursing homes.
Burke says it's possible that nursing home residents' dementia could get worse because of the loneliness. But he also says some might bounce back once visitations can resume, adding, but who knows when that'll be.
I don't know if I'll ever see her again, sit with her again, brush the hair from her face, or hold her hand. And I wonder, when the coronavirus is finally tamed, will she know me?
Jerry's journal is now more than 160 pages long, double-spaced, printed out. She told me the process gives her purpose and gives meaning to her mother's life. She'll continue to write down these talks, so she has them when they can no longer happen.
Don't forget me, she said. I will never forget you, Mom. You are on my mind 24 hours a day. I love you.
In Lubbock, I'm Sarah Self-Walbrick.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
You've got it tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Huntington's disease is a brain disorder. It affects a person's movement, intellectual abilities, even emotions. Ruben Solis of Waxahachie has Huntington's. To the untrained eye, he may look like he is erratic, even drunk. That's reportedly how some Ellis County sheriff's officers interpreted his behavior after he called them for a safe ride home. Instead, court documents say the elderly man was thrown to the ground and handcuffed. That was in 2019. The Texas Legal Services Center sued Ellis County on behalf of Solis, alleging police brutality and discrimination under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And now there is some resolution. For that, we turn to Wayne Krause Yang. He is a longtime civil rights attorney and the managing attorney at Texas Legal Services Center. Wayne, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Was there anything unique about what happened to Ruben Solis, or does this happen with law enforcement all the time?
Police are often trained to shoot first and ask questions later. These police officers not only came in with that mentality, but they also had no training, no idea whatsoever Mr. Solis's disability was, or even how to interact properly with somebody who has a disability. Unfortunately, this is an all too common scenario. Years back, the Austin Police Department arrested and brutalized an elderly blind deaf man and his deaf wife. He had been at a restaurant and the police were called. And instead of communicating or attempting to communicate with this gentleman and his wife, they talked only with the people in the restaurant. And when the police officers came in, they grabbed him and he thought he was being assaulted. So he didn't just sit there gently for them. Well, the police officers then took an 80-year-old blind deaf man and beat him, arrested him, and handcuffed him as well. Something they didn't know at the time, and is another important part of disability training, is that by handcuffing him, they took away his most important ability to communicate as somebody who spoke sign language. These are things that law enforcement, if they don't receive training and policies, they can really silence and abuse people who have disabilities and really do so entirely unknowingly and without intent.
I mentioned we have a resolution now to this lawsuit. What is it?
Well, the Ellis County Sheriff is going to make sweeping changes. They will adopt a new detailed policy on interaction with people with disabilities. They're going to take de-escalation training. And this is all of their deputies, around 125 folks. In addition, Ellis County also will make sure they have 25 mental health officers as part of the settlement. This is going to make all of Ellis County much safer, especially for people with disabilities, but also for the very deputies who will be out there on the streets.
Now, Mr. Solis had a case here, right? I mean, he was injured. He could have gotten a settlement, I would guess. Why would he trade that all in?
The primary purpose of his case from the beginning, the reason he wanted to stand up for his rights, is to make a difference, to make sure this didn't happen to somebody else in the future. And that's what he was able to do.
Now, you mentioned Ellis County had no training or policies for interacting with people with disabilities. Is that unusual across Texas?
Sadly, it's not. When we began this case, we hoped maybe they had any mental health officers or even a little bit of training. But no, they had no policies, no training, nothing. And across the state, you'll see that very frequently. It's not something that's part of a basic training for a law enforcement official. And it's really at the core of why the sheriff's deputies saw Mr. Solis. He told them within 2 minutes that he had Huntington's disease, and yet they ended up beating him, handcuffing him, and arresting him within 3 minutes of meeting him.
We couldn't speak with Mr. Solis today. How is he doing?
Mr. Solis is really relieved to be done with this and also very proud. He took a really difficult situation, a traumatic life experience, and he made something positive of it. It's a real tribute to his courage.
Wayne Krause Yang is a longtime civil rights attorney and the managing attorney at Texas Legal Services Center. Wayne, thank you again.
Thank you for looking into this.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. And it's time again in the show to check in with social media editor Wells Dunbar. Wells, what are Texans talking about out there?
Hey, Laura. Well, bad news for college sports fans. A college football season may appear increasingly less likely as reports the Big Ten College Sports Conference in the Northeast has voted to cancel its college football season. The Detroit Free Press reporting the news, adding that a formal announcement is expected Tuesday. And Laura, this news comes on the heels of reports from ESPN and others that members of the so-called Power Five conferences, including the Texas-heavy Big 12 conference, held an emergency meeting Sunday to discuss the possibility of a canceled football season this fall, obviously owing to the COVID-19 pandemic.
I think
it was
the MAC. I'm getting all my football, you know,
all your conference affiliations.
No. Yeah,
it's easy. It's easy to do. But obviously a problem that's affecting schools across the nation. We're hearing from folks across Texas about this news and the potential of a canceled season. Lots of folks chiming in via Twitter. Joe Hutchison says there needs to be a plan with safety protocols for every college football team wanting to play. The NBA and WNBA have been great about testing, keeping distance, masks, etc. Look at those outcomes and try to adapt to the processes for college football. If not, that's okay. Just postpone football. And another tweet here from Sept. Sept tweets, I think if certain people had behaved like rational adults in the spring and summer, they could have fall sports. Instead, he tweets, they acted like spoiled children, and so now they have to have their treats taken away. Harsh prescription there, but obviously one that has folks talking. Again, too, with college football hitting in the fall, just as the cold and flu season is will start its annual procession there. So lots of folks, lots of chatter online about the danger that that could pose as well.
And the second wave, they've long predicted, as you said, it's going to be something we're all watching for, I think, holding our breaths.
Definitely so. Well, more pandemic news. A tweet I just saw come up from a friend of the show, Travis Bubinek, reporter for Courthouse News. He tweets that the oil field services sector has lost almost 100,000 jobs since the pandemic began. This according to a new report, from the Petroleum Equipment and Services Association, this monthly report from them. And apparently, as the economy began this somewhat of a rebound after shedding, that just historic amount of jobs in, I think, 20 million or so by rough estimate. As the U.S. economy added 1.8 million jobs back last month, oil fields services jobs still fell by 9,300 in July. So obviously a sector that's very hard hit by the double whammy going on here with the lack of travel and that glut of oil we had.
Well, and it's one of those things we talk about all the time. It's not, it's one job that affects, another industry that serves that industry. And then the people who, also serve food, have all kinds of different interconnected ways of having ripple effects. Thank you so much, Wells Dunbar. Thank you for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow on the Texas Standard.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation,
Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.